one that is echo-thirds, it's ADAC.
Yes, okay, thank you very much for inviting me here. And my father will like the pictures that I'm going to bring him very much because he's an architect. So, and I'm of course happy to be here and speak. So I'm going to talk about spectral curves in ADS-CFT and the way of quantizing that. So that will be about how to obtain string energies or how to obtain anomalous dimensions of local operators in engaged theory. So it's based on work with Volodya Kazakov, Katsuhiro Sakai, Matthias Staudacher, and Kostya Zaremba over the, well, mostly over the past year. So first of all, let me give you a brief introduction into the topic that I'll speak about. So it's about the ADS-CFT correspondence, which, among other things, it tells you that string energies and gauge dimensions should, or the spectrum of string energies and the spectrum of gauge anomalous dimensions should match. So you get this relation. This is a very nice proposal, but certainly it's also very hard to test because of the strong weak duality nature of this duality. So it's a nice proposal, but can't really test it. So in 33 years ago, there have been two proposals of how to maybe overcome this strong weak nature. And in those proposals, one considers states with a large spin on S5 or of flavor S6 symmetry. The first of them is the famous BMN limit. There have been various extensions to this, non-planar computations and near, so corrections to this BMN limit, one of J corrections. There have been various agreements have been found in this context. And the second line is semi-classical spinning strings, where again you take very, very long local operators, and but now, as opposed to BMN, you scatter in many of many excitations, which, however, all take coherent states. So all the excitations move along this local operator in a coherent fashion. In both of these proposals, one gets an effective coupling constant, lambda prime, which is lambda over j squared, which can be taken, or which can be assumed to be small, no matter if lambda itself is small or large. So that's how you would think strong weak nature might be overcome. So in string theory, one finds that one gets an expansion in powers of lambda prime, and also in powers of 1 over j, where 1 over j essentially counts the string sigma model loops, and that's this 1 over j parameter is the h bar of the quantization that I'm going to talk about. In gauge theory, this goes a bit differently. In gauge theory, one finds that the L loop contribution to anomalous dimension turns out to be suppressed by at least 1 over, at least 2 L factors of 1 over j, so you might reorganize the series also in power of lambda prime. So one finds then that the expansion in lambda prime is apparently equivalent to the expansion in lambda, and one is certainly tempted to compare that. And that works quite nicely, but if you go through three loops, which is to say three powers in this effective coupling constant, then all of a sudden you find a mismatch in the near BMN, like the first 1 over j correction. And then if you do a similar analysis for the spinning strings, you find a similar disagreement also there. And all of this is not to say that ADS-CFT is bound to be wrong. It's only saying that these proposals maybe don't quite work as well as one had originally thought. So there might be order of limits issues involved. that give you a different result depending on if lambda is small or large. So I don't really have anything new to say on this issue, but well, it's still there. So so let me give you an outline of the talk. So first of all, I'm going to talk about string solutions. I'm going to review string solutions, what has been done in this context and what cannot be done, or put differently, all the easy things have been done a long, long time ago, and all the difficult ones seem to be, well, too difficult to solve explicitly. So anyway, then I'm going to discuss classical superstrings on AVS 5 process 5. and try to do as well as one can do, according to what I reviewed before. So I tried to construct a spectral curve for any solution, and then, this at least gives us some understanding of how the spectrum of strings is organized, and then express the curve through integral equations. That makes a comparison to gauge theory a bit more transparent. Because then I'd like to focus on n equals 4 perturbative, n equals 4 gauge theory. And in this system, I'd like to derive a spin chain S matrix, at least in the subsector, for higher loops. And then construct a set of algebraic equations by means of a nested beta under. And then these algebraic equations are somewhat similar to the integral equations you get here. And well, as I don't have the full result here, and here I don't have the quantum result, I try to combine the two results into algebraic equations for the complete model, so which gives you perturbative n equals 4 at higher loops, as well as maybe hopefully classical quantum superstrings on AVS 5 versus 5. So in all what I'll be talking about, I'll assume classical strings and non-interacting strings. No, strings are not splitting. And in gauge theory, it will be perturbative gauge theory. The coupling constant G or lambda will be very small. And it will be a planar element, large N gauge theory. So let me start with something we all know, strings in flat space. The equations of motion are as simple as that, and we can easily solve them by means of Fourier transformation. So we get a mode decomposition, and the solution, or a generic solution, is expressed through all these amplitude vectors, one for each mode of the string, and for each orientation of the string oscillation. So this is a little bit too general, because there are also the Virasoro constraints. Well, like that. And anyway, the solutions that we get, we can classify by these amplitudes. I wrote the absolute value here. I only mean the absolute value of each component. I say they are classified by that because these are essentially the time-independent. This is time-independent information on the strings. Whereas the phases, the complex phases of these amplitudes, they vary with time. So I'm only interested in the time invariant part. And you can say the amplitudes are the action variables of the string, whereas the phases are the angular variables from the string and Hamilton Jacobi formula. So it's then easy to quantize the system. You get a string Hamiltonian, which is just this harmonic oscillator. And again, you see the only thing that really matters is the amplitude of A and not the phase in A. So why am I telling you all this? This is because I'd like to do something similar for strings in AVS 5 versus 5. Well, it won't certainly be as straightforward as this, but I hope I can convince you that the final result is somewhat similar. So there are various ways which one could take to attack the problem in AVS 5 versus 5. You could consider it as an expansion around plane waves. That was in the context of the BMN plane wave correspondence. lot of research done there. And well, let's start in plain ways. The string solution, the string can be exactly solved again. It's given by quite the same expression. Again, the string is characterized by the amplitudes, and we can quantize the amplitudes from all of them to string oscillators. And then we get string theory on ADS5 plus 5 as a Hamiltonian. But now, when you want to go away from plane waves, you have to take into account the curvature corrections to this. And excuse me, this introduces interactions to the string oscillators, quartic, sixth order, and so on and so forth. And each of these interactions also comprises infinitely many terms because the well, because you have infinitely many modes. So that seems to be a very complicated problem. And well, the first correction has been performed, I think, in all cases, but or in most cases. But if you want to go to the second order perturbation theory, it's already very complicated, and I think there are no results known yet. So I mean, we can start with plane waves, but we are also stuck on plane waves, and we can't really go to the interesting features of ADS5 versus 5. On the other hand, these results will be very, very important well, for the function to confirm or to check the final result. Okay, we could try something else. We could try to directly find all the solutions to the equations of motion. And many examples have been investigated over the last couple of years. Well, people have investigated folded strings. These are much like the strings in flat space. So you have this, say, rigid string which just rotates and moves forward. And you can do the same in a curved state. There have been circular solutions, also pulsating solutions. For all of them, there are also higher modes, which means that the string is multiply folded or multiply wound. And maybe in this context, you can say plane wave strings are very, very short, very tiny strings. But there you can do quantum fluctuations, so I throw a bit further around. OK, so let me just review one of those solutions. What you usually do is you make some ansatz for the string. So you say the time, well, let's focus on R cross S2, which is the subspace of A5 plus S5. So you say the time coordinate is, well, just linear, is coupled to the worksheet time. And the position of the sphere is parameterized by an angle, by it's first of all, it's just spinning with a constant angular momentum, and it's extended in one of the directions on S2, like that. So, and then, well, you have the equations of motion, you can solve them, and one finds that the profile of the string is given by some Jacobi amplitude function, and there are two integration constants. Some angle and some other modulus. This modulus relates the energy to the spin. So this is the most general solution, but we're not quite there yet because we have to take into account that the string is it's a closed string, it's periodic. So we need to impose periodicity, and well, there are two ways you can do that. You can have a folded string or a circular string, which is well essentially Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions. When you do that, you what do you do? Yes, you can find out about this modulus eta, and then you can express the spin and the energy in terms of this modulus eta. Same for the circular string, you get slightly different functions, but the general picture seems to be even for more complicated solutions. You can express all the spins on ADS5 and on S5 and also the energy in terms of a couple of these moduli. And well, the easiest solutions you find, these functions, they are algebraic, elliptic, or even hyperelliptic if you want to. And Or you can now ask, why are those functions elliptic functions? And what is the meaning of these moduli? Where do you get them from? Say, for an elliptic solution, you would expect there to be some kind of hidden torus in the game. And try to answer that question. OK? So right. So we've seen that well, I mean, in general, it will be too difficult to solve all the string solutions. If we want to quantize that, well, that's certainly not a way. So we can't quantize as in flat space or plane waves where we know all the solutions before. And also, it's very difficult to expand around the plane waves. And even if we can do a few orders, it will always be just an expansion. And maybe we don't see all of A as much because it's five in this way. So what should we do now? Well, I propose we should really give up on finding the exact energy spectrum as we could in plane waves, or flat strings, flat space. Instead, we can try to classify the solutions and understand at least the structure of the spectrum. And then if we know that, we can try to quantize that, whatever it means. But I'll propose a way of how this could be done. So what I'm now going to do is I'd like to extract all the conserved charges from a string solution. And that we can do by means of a Lux pair, Lux connection, and a monodular matrix. So that's all based on integrability. And I'll investigate their analytic properties. And from these properties, I can try to reconstruct a corresponding algebraic curve. And finally, I'd like to discretize the curve. That's the part about gauge theory. I hope I have enough time to talk about that. So let's start with the supersymmetric sigma model for strings on ADS5 plus S5. So the ADS5 plus S5 superspace is the coset space of this superconformal group PSU 2 to 4 over SP1 comma 1 and SP2. And well, you can essentially just construct this model in the usual way of constructing the coset space sigma models. So you start with this connection, this usual connection. And well, it's a flat connection. And well, this coset space has some Z4 grading associated to it. And you can split up the connection into four pieces. H, which is associated to this quotient group, and three other pieces, which have different gradings under Z4. So now we do the coset identification. So we identify this group element or the embedding by elements of the quotient group. And we write down an action. This is the usual coset action. And this is for the supersymmetric part. You include the kernels in this way. And here, there's another part which essentially projects U2 to 4 to the PSU 2 to 4 part. OK. So from these, from the action, you can read off the Noether charges and the Noether current. So the Noether current is given by this expression, the combination of P, Q, and Q. Of course, the quotient part of the quotient group is not associated with that. And you can express the equations of motion as the conservation condition of the car, the symmetry car. That's a Lagrange multiplier which enforces PSU224 instead of PSU224. It appears here, which is essentially to say that the abelian element in this matrix, so all these things are 8x8 super matrices, and the abelian element in this matrix should be disregarded. It's not part of PSU. So it's not a problem that lambda appears here. Well, in addition to that, you have the various Sora constraints, which give you worksheet reparameterization invariants. So you can express them quite easily using super traces only of the of this bosonic field P. And now let's just start with some abstract solution to these equations, to the three equations that define classical superstring, and try to extract some useful quantities from this. And that we can do by means of the Lux connection, or Lux pair. So that's a family of flat connection which is usually associated to integrability of the model. So you introduce a spectral parameter, let's call it Z in this case, the complex parameter, and well, A, this is just a flat, one can verify that this is a flat connection if J is flat and K is conserved, so if the equations of motion hold. This family of flat connections is analytic for all values of Z except the point zero at infinity, where you can see that there are poles here. So and there's also one spectral point for it, point Z equals one. So if you set Z equals one, you just get the usual connection back. So you can maybe view it as an extension of the usual coset space connection, but to include also the conserved current. So far this equation you could view as just a fancy way of expressing the equations of motion and the flatness condition, but now it's a flat connection. And you can also do the thing that you might wish to do with flat connections. You could compute a Wilson loop with it. And so you compute a Wilson loop of the flat connection around the string. And because it's flat, it's independent of the path you take. As a standard, it only depends on the base point of the path. But also, this appears only in a very mild way, because the shift in this base point only leads to a similarity transformation of the monodomy. So the monodomy is called the Wilson loop. And this is good because similarity transformation doesn't change the eigenvalues. So we can take the eigenvalues of the monodomy. And well, there are eight eigenvalues. We just like to parameterize them as e to the I p, where p is called the quasi momentum for some reason that I actually never understood. But anyway, so we have four eigenvalues which are loosely speaking associated to alias 5, and four eigenvalues which are associated to S 5, and and these quasi momenta now, these eigenvalues, they are conserved in gauge invariant quantities. So you can call these really the physical information of the string solution. And that's really good because these quasi momenta depend on the spectral parameter. So so in some sense we started off with the wave function, which depends on the coordinate of the worksheet, and now we've transformed it into something more abstract, a quasi-momentum, which depends also on one complex parameter. It actually depends on it analytically. So we've traded in one problem for the other one, but this seems more easy to treat, and most importantly, these quantities are physical. All the gauge degrees of freedom have been projected out. So you could think this is a very convenient the convenient quantities for doing quantization. And actually, we believe that the information in here is equivalent to the set of action variables in some algorithmic Jacobian formula. So.
Sorry, you start this problem with the action that you considered at the beginning.
Yes.
You didn't talk about Hamiltonian probabilism.
I didn't talk about this, no. If you want to do that, you have to do gauge fixing and so on and so forth. The good thing about this is you never have to do gauge fixing at any point. Because here you project out all the gauge degrees of freedom. The only thing you have are these quadrimomenta, which are time independent.
So can you be sure that this is the same? This is a good into.
Well, no, I mean, this is merely a conjecture that this describes everything. But as I argued, these depend on one parameter as well as the wave function depends also on sigma coordinate. So,
yeah. I mean, there's some hope. The question is, do they commute?
Well, that I can't answer. But, I mean, there should be some which commute, right? So I mean, there's clearly something one could think about here. So I said they contain all the interesting physical quantities, so they should at least contain the global charges, and the global charges are certainly important because if you want to compare anything to gauge theory, the global or the symmetry, the charges of the global symmetry, those you can certainly directly compare to gauge theory because the symmetry group is the same. So let's see how to get these global charges from the monodromy or from the quasi-elementa. So for that, we expand the family of flat connections around the point one. At point one, we get the flat connection of this coset space, which is the sigma model. And then in next next order, we get the symmetry current. So if we expand the monodromy around this point, we actually get first of all the identity, and in next order we get the neuter charge of the string. So if we expand the monodromy around one, we get the symmetry charges. We can also when we diagonalize this matrix S, we find the quasi-momenta, and so the quasi-momenta of AES5, they give you the three quantum numbers or the three conserved charges associated to AES5, two spins and the energy. And for S5, we get just three spins. Okay. So these are the global charges. There's, I mean, I've argued that the monodromy is analytic in Z, but there are also some symmetry is associated to monodromy. So the Z4 property I've been talking about before, that's actually is directly translated to directly related to supertransposes. So supertransposes differ from normal transposes slightly because the double transpose doesn't give you back the original matrix, but gives you a conjugated matrix. And only if you take the supertranspose four times, you get the original matrix back. So that's the Z4 property. And well, the connection under a supertranspose just forms in this way. So the four components that I talked about, they transform differently. And now taking supertransposes has this particular effect on the monodromy. So we see when we replace the spectral parameter Z by IZ, so take this map Z going to IZ, then we get back the monodromy matrix, actually the inverse and the supertranspose of it, which is and also conjugated. But essentially, this is the symmetry. This is just the transformation under this symmetry, Z into phi Z. And we can transform this into, or we can derive what's the transformation of the quasi momenta. And well, these are given by that. So under the map, the quasi momenta get mixed up a bit, and you take the negative of them. And here's also. Anyway, if you do it twice, you see that well, Z going to minus Z actually a trivial symmetry of quasi momenta. So we might be tempted to express everything only in terms of Z squared and not in terms of Z. So I'll introduce a different spectral parameter X, which relates to Z in this way, but it's not really so important how they are related. Only that one, well, X is somewhat equivalent to Z. One is the double covering of the other.
So what is Y and what is C again?
C is some conjugation matrix. Some constant conjugation matrix.
And Y is trivial.
Pardon? This one?
No.
Oh. That is some matrix associated to supertranspose. What this does is it inverts all the actually inverts all the fermionic pieces of the supermatrix. Okay. So what we've seen so far is here we see where the super where the global charges are. Here is a certain symmetry of the monogamy matrix. We can also consider the analyticity properties of the monogamy. And well, as the monogamy is just an integral of the Lux connection, it certainly must be analytic in Z, because the Lux connection is. Certainly except the points where the connection is not analytic, so 0 and infinity. Let's consider the point z equals 0. At this point, or at any point where you get a singularity in the Lux connection, we can actually diagonalize it perturbatively. So we take this connection, and conjugate it by some matrix T which is regular at the point 0. So when you do this, expand it, we find that the derivative or whatever happens to the derivative here must also be regular because T is regular. But the transformation of this part stays singular. So we can actually use T to diagonalize the most singular behavior of A. So when we diagonalize the Kamiya flat connections, we find that the most singular part is given, is this diagonal matrix, and it doesn't have as many independent components like A as you would think, but there's some degeneracy due to the conjugation property, due to the tracelessness of P, and also due to the Virasoro constraint. So we have only two independent parameters in the most singular behavior. Which then just means that four of the quasi momenta at the point 0 will go like alpha over z squared, and the other four go like theta over z squared. So now we know the behavior of the quasi momenta at 0, same way we can derive it at infinity. And but these are not all the singularities you find in the quasi momenta. So that's because the diagonalization. So we diagonalize the monotomy to get the quasi momenta, and this diagonalization introduces new singularities. And we talk about them, or let me explain to you where they come from. So let's consider two of the eigenvalues. Say this eigenvalue e to the pk and e to the ipl. They at some point in the spectral parameter plane, at some point they cross. And well, you can investigate this by looking just at a 2x2 matrix. Say you have a 2x2 matrix which is analytic in some parameter, and you find the eigenvalues of this matrix. You get this formula here. And so you see, well, this vanishes when the two eigenvalues are the same. So at the point where the eigenvalues become the same, you generally expect a square root similarity. And so if you draw this around this singular point, you see that here you get a branch point. These two the two eigenvalues, well, so somewhat they become one. So if you take a full turn around this singular point, you actually interchange the two eigenvalues. And well, this merely says that the way we label the eigenvalues, so when we label them 1, 2, 3, 4, we can't do that uniquely over the whole complex plane. And so we need to introduce some branch cuts. The branch cuts start at these singularities and also end at them. So this is what happens when you take two eigenvalues which cross and which belong to the same set of eigenvalues. So we have eigenvalues belonging to ABS5 and eigenvalues belonging to S5. So these were two belonging to ABS5, but now let's consider what happens when you have one eigenvalue for ABS5 and one for S5. So here we need to diagonalize a supermatrix, a 2x2 supermatrix, and the eigenvalues for this matrix are given by these two expressions. So again, we can find the generic behavior at the generate eigenvalues in this way. And now we see here we don't get a square root, but instead we get a pole. And so this is kind of what fermions look in this game. So fermions are poles. And the residue of this pole, quite interesting, it's a product of two odd numbers, two odd Grassmann numbers. So it's actually a nilpotent number. But actually, we can mostly forget about this information, and just treat it as some regular number. So maybe what I should say is, you can view the cuts as some condensate, the cuts that I talked before. Those are bosonic degrees of freedom, and you can consider them as some condensate of many singularities close to each other. And here, the fermions also produce singularities, but due to the Pauli principle, they just can't condensate. So they stay poles and can't become cuts. Okay. So if you put all this together, you find the spectral curve for the system. So it looks somewhat like this. You have eight eigenvalues. Each eigenvalue has a Riemann sheaf. So you have four eigenvalues associated to S5 and four associated to ADS5. And you get the singularities, the two that I've been talking about in the X-plane. They are at minus and plus one. You get cuts between two like sheets, between two ADS sheets or between two S sheets. And you get fermionic singularities when you go from a sheet of this type to a sheet of that type. You also get the symmetry. So whenever you have a cut at say, C2, on this curve C2, there should also be a cut on the curve 1 over C2 somewhere. Okay, so, and actually, if you just have finitely many cuts and singularities, then, well, the derivative of the quasi-momentum momenta, that's an algebraic curve. And the simplest spinning strings are precisely associated to these algebraic curves. Say they have genus 0 or genus 1, you get algebraic or elliptic functions. And this is somewhat explained. So this explains why you get those functions to express the energies. So let me just finally try to explain where these moduli come from, or maybe how to get the action variables. So the eigenvalues certainly must be single value for each complex parameter. You should have precisely one eigenvalue. But this is only for each VIP. So if you consider this curve P of P prime, then all closed cycles of DP should be zero, or at least they should be a multiple of 2 pi, so that e to the ip is single value. So well, you can now use these integers that you get to characterize the curve. So you can say, for a serious cut, you have an A cycle which goes around the cut, and a B cycle which goes from infinity through a cut back to infinity. You can say the A cycle should be zero. You can arrange that. The B cycles, they give you some integers, the n's. You can say this n is the string mode number associated to this cut. And you can associate another continuous parameter to the cut, which essentially describes the length of this cut, how large it is. So this is the amplitude. You can express it through the integral of P on the x side. So it turns out that if you count all the moduli of the curve, you find that there's one amplitude for each bosonic cut, which is somewhat similar to the strings in flat space, where you have also the mode numbers, and for each mode number you can specify the amplitude of this string oscillator.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So when you have this, this is referring to the previous Dupont's constants. When you have degenerate eigenvalues,
yes,
like A equals B, and then the information about B and C, I mean, then it becomes a sort of non-abelian problem in that. I'm saying that then the information about P's is not quite specifying
Right. So you have an open Wilson loop, but as I argued, the only thing that is really invariant are the eigenvalues. And the off-diagonal elements, they in some sense depend on the position where you start the Wilson loop. So you don't really want to know about them.
So it's not a one-to-one correspondence then, because if you specify at those points, specifying the degenerate eigenvalue does not quite. This is some sort of gauge fixing which is failing at that point, right? You say that if I want to specify my Wilson loop by just the eigenvalues, and then there are these points where.
Right. You can say the information of the physical information on the string, how it goes through target space, essentially is described by where all these branch points, where the eigenvalue crossings appear in the spectral parameter plane. But the only thing that really matters are the eigenvalues, and they become non-analytic due to crossings. And then finally, one last thing about the algebraic curve here, or the spectral curve, is you can parameterize the spectral curve by these integrals or by sums. So instead of specifying the curve, you can also specify all the discontinuities of the cuts and also all the singularities. And this leads you to some integral equations which kind of look like this. So, well, you have seven functions which you express through integrals, and here are some singular integral equations that determine determine those curves which you send as lines. And here, the Cartan matrix of the symmetry group appears, and there are some functions, some potential terms, F, I call them, draws depend on these functions. I'm not going to specify them. They are somewhat complicated, but they really determine how the model behaves. So this is all I want to say about string theory. And now I'd like to quantize this system. Let me tell you what I mean by quantization. Quantization seems to be quite natural in VH theory. So let me first of all explain what you have in VH theory. In VH theory, you consider local operators. So these are single phase operators. Let's for simplicity consider, first of all, only two complex scalars, which you put in the trace. This, the order, of course, matters because all these fields, by one, by two, they are matrices. And you can also represent this in a graphical fashion like this. And this is already suggestive as a spin chain. So you can also view this as a spin chain state where you identify phi 1 with spin up and phi 2 with spin down. So you write the state like this, and you can also draw it like this, where it spins up and down. And here, I'm going to talk about the length of the spin chain. The length is the number of sites in the spin chain, or equivalently, the number of fields of the local operator. And well, if you want to compare to string theory, what you should do is you should consider such spin chains with very many fields. So you have thermodynamic limits, spins come very close. And so if you get something smooth, this might be the world sheet of a closed oriented string. Well, this is actually a little bit too easy, because what you have to consider is operator mixing. So any reasonable local operator or eigenoperators, they will be quantum superpositions of these, say, basis states. And well, you want to find anomalous dimensions of local operators. And it's especially if you have very many fields, it's very difficult to solve this mixing problem. And so you can compute these anomalous dimensions in a gauge theory by computing higher refinement diagrams. But alternatively, you can also view the scaling dimensions as eigenvalues of the dilatation operator of the theory. The dilatation operator is one of the generators of the conformal group. So what you have to do is you have to solve this eigenvalue problem. So these you have to solve for the eigenoperators, and then the eigenvalues are of the dilatation operator are the anomalous dimensions, so the scaling dimensions of the fields. And you can obtain the quantum corrections in perturbation theory. So let me say G is proportional to the square root of the total coupling constant. And then the dilatation operator becomes something. You can also view it in perturbation theory. So there's a classical piece, there's a one-loop piece, and there are higher order corrections. And all these corrections, they come from Feynman diagrams. So let me explain what I mean by these corrections. So consider a correction which looks like that. What you do with this correction, insert it at all places in the local in this spin chain or local operator. And well, see what the Feynman diagram does to your fields. So what it usually does is it permutes a few fields. It can also recombine the fields. But there are, I mean, it's what it does is it preserves the spins of the field. I mean, the total spin of the field preserves also the all the charges, and it certainly preserves the classical dimensions. And all these conservations make it feasible to actually derive a few first few loop corrections to the orientation operator without actually computing the Feynman diagrams. So you can compute these corrections by algebraic mean. Let me also say these interactions, you insert them homogeneously. It doesn't depend on the position where you insert them. And also, you can have dynamic interactions where the number of spin chain sites fluctuates, where that is changed. So that's something very unusual for spin chains. Okay. So, and then during the last few years, it became more and more obvious that this dilatation operator, if you view it as a Hamiltonian, like consider this Hamiltonian here, it is an integrable Hamiltonian. So that's a very very special property for spin chain Hamiltonians, and you can make use of it to actually diagonalize it. So that's what you do with the beta ansatz. So let's consider not all the fields in the theory, but let's start with something simple, where we have two scalars from Z and Phi, like before, and also put in a fermion. So let's consider the Hamiltonian. For this system, I'll just consider the anomalous dimension, so the dilatation operator without the classical piece. I just divide out one power of the coupling constant. And so now, let's try to diagonalize the system. The easiest thing you can do is you can consider a vacuum configuration. In a vacuum, there would only be fields of one type, say only these fields Z. And this is a half BPS state, and therefore it's protected, and the Hamiltonian, or there's no anomalous dimension, precisely zero to all those coupling points. Okay, so these vacuum configurations, they are simple. Let's try one particle states. For the one particle states, we also take this infinitely long vacuum, but we put in one of these excitations, one of the scalars, and either the scalar phi or the fermion psi. Put it at some position A and make a plane wave solution. Plane wave solution is suitable because the Hamiltonian is homogeneous. So let's take plane wave with momentum p. That will be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And you get from that the dispersion relation. So if we know that, well, we know for this sector, we know the Hamiltonian up to three loops. And so we can derive the dispersion relation of these excitations up to at least three loops. The dispersion relation is the same for the scalar as for the fermion, which is required by supersymmetry. And we can also conjecture the asymptotic form. So not only the first three loops, but actually two arbitrary high loop orders. And that we can make use of the plane wave limit. So in the plane in the plane wave story, the dispersion relation is known. So we might find something. And we found an expression. An all loop expression which at least works at the first three loop orders. Okay, so we know how to diagonize the vacuum. Well, the vacuum is easy. One particle states are plane waves. Now let's try to diagonize two particle states. So you take a state, put two particles in there, and put in some wave function. So when these two particles are far apart, because the interaction is local, we can diagonalize it at least asymptotically. So this state, this wave function should also be a direct product of two plane waves, at least when A is very different from B. And therefore, also the energy should be known. So the energy for the system is just the sum of the two plane waves that we use. However, when the two excitations come very close, they interact, and something happens. But well, this is an integral system, and well, so we can solve what happens in the middle, and from this we derive a scattering matrix. So we just say we define the isotropics of the state. So when this particle is here and this particle is there, it's just the plane waves. And when the two particles have interchanged, it's still plane waves, but there's a phase factor in between. And so this is the S matrix, and in this way we can derive the S matrix up to three loops. And we've also conjectured the isotropic form, so the all loop generalization to that. And actually, that's quite a neat expression because it's very short and describes what happens up to three loops correctly. So you might hope that it also describes what happens at higher loops. And it's also some type of S matrix that is apparently not yet known, has never been found in the business of spin chains. So this is two particle states. Let's go on to higher particle states. First of all, for that you can show that the S matrix satisfies the Young-Baxter equation. If you just draw it pictorially, it looks like this. It just tells you that it doesn't matter in which order, if you have three particles and if the scattering factorizes, it just tells you it doesn't matter in which order you factorize the scattering. So, well, now, if this is the correct three particle S matrix, then, if the scattering factorizes, then we can derive the states then we can derive all eigenstates of the system. So a state is composed from many partial wave functions. In each partial wave function, all the particles have a definite ordering, and you can connect the different partial wave functions by S matrices, which just interchange the particles, and so this gives you a phase factor. So you just for each partial wave function, you know the overall phase factor. You add them together, you get an eigenstate. So in this way, you can find all eigenstates of the infinitely long spin chain. But that's not what we wanted, because we are only interested in finite length spin chains, and that's where what the Bethe equation does. So you want to impose periodicity. So you still look at an infinitely long spin chain, but you want to impose periodicity so that you can put it on a periodic finite spin chain. So, but for periodicity, you need to demand that this step, just some state, must be equivalent to the state where you take one excitation and shift it once across, shift it by one length of the periodic lattice. And by this, you cross all the other excitations, and you also step L steps by this plane wave. So this equation is actually the periodicity condition, and it quantizes all the admissible momenta for this system. And well, as it stands, it still is a matrix-based equation because you have two types of excitations, scalars and fermions, and they can mix. So say, when you put in a fermion here, it might go from here to there and do very strange things. So still, it's not easy to solve this system, but you can apply a nested beta answers. And for that, you try to repeat the steps I've explained before. So again, you just start with the lattice, But you have only excitations phi. If you have only excitations phi, there's no mixing, and that's now an easy problem. Now you replace one of the new vacuum fields by the fermion and diagonalize that. So in this way, you get a new dispersion relation for a new excitation, which takes phi to psi. And then next step, you take two phi's and replace it by psi. In this way, you get an S matrix for these excitations that take phi to psi. And now this new S matrix then is diagonal. So you have a diagonal S matrix, and you have two types of excitations. Take the vacuum to phi in the first level, and take phi to psi in the second level. Okay, so you do that. you find the Bethe equations. As I said, you have two types of excitations. Let's call them 4 and 5 for some reason, which you find on next frequency. And then the Bethe equations you can write down. It's only these two equations that describe the system. There are some functions, x plus minus, and u, which I don't specify here, but they are also quite easy. So these equations determine the spectrum of all states on a periodic spin chain for the system. Furthermore, you should impose cyclicity of the trace to make things work for gauge theory. And then finally, you can read off, I mean, if you've solved the system, if you've determined all the momentum, then you can find what's the anomalous dimension, or what's the energy eigenvalue of the system in this simple fashion. You just take this one sum. Okay. So this gives you the spectrum in one subsector up to, well, at least three loops, but if this is not correct, maybe also to higher loops. And then we've made a conjecture of how the complete system might work. So if you exclude all possible scalars, all fermions, all derivatives, so you get a system of Bethe equation. You have now seven types of excitation. These are the Bethe equations. Here are some functions u, which I don't specify, but So again, here the Cartan matrix of the algebra appears, and before I explain you how we got to there, let me first of all maybe tell you why we think that these equations to the are the correct Bethe equation for n equals 4. So first of all, if you take the one-loop limit of these equations, you find the Bethe equations that we've derived earlier. Then I think what's most important is these equations actually give you the correct free-loop anomalous dimensions for several states that I've derived before. So at least up to three loops, and in some sectors it produces the right results, but the form is quite suggestive that it works for the whole theory. There are some aspects of dynamic spin chains that you can observe in the Bethe equations. So the fact that the number of spin chain sites is not conserved can be actually seen in the equations. What's important is you have to restrict to the zero momentum states, so cyclic states, or the traces that you find in gauge theory. That's crucial for the equations to work. But furthermore, it's also crucial that you take particularly this symmetry algebra, PSU 224, which is to say that n equals 4, we all know that it's a very special theory, so it seems that these Bethe equations are also very, very special. However, which is maybe a bit disappointing, but anyway, the model, these equations still have several free parameters. So you can get different models. One of the models could be n equals 4 to Hamiltonian, and one other model could be could be the quantum space. Okay, so let me now tell you how to compare this to string theory. Actually, we really started at the expressions for string theory and tried to derive some equations which give you the right comparison to classical strings. So if you want to compare it to classical strings, you should consider very long spin chains, or, well, this is the thermodynamic limit. So we have very long spin chains. The number of excitations, or the number of beta roots, should all also be of the same order as length. And you would like to consider a low energy limit, so where the energy scale is 1 over L. In this limit, all the beta roots, which are somewhere scattered in the complex plane, they will start to condense on certain curves in the complex space. So in the thermodynamic limit, you don't have beta roots anymore, but you have these curves with some densities on them. And, well, maybe some of the roots may stay single and not condensed, so these would maybe compare to the fermionic excitations, which remain singular. In this limit, then, the discrete sums turn into integrals. So also the products you can express as sums with these densities. So whenever you see a sum or a product like this, you can replace it by an integral like that. So this also, I mean, this integral looks like what we had before in string theory. And then you derive the thermodynamic limit of the beta equations. And this yields you this system of integral equations, which is precisely the same as in string theory, but certainly we have to specify the potentials. So the potentials, these potentials here, they are derived from the functions u that of the beta equations. So I mean, what needs to be done then is to compare the functions to string theory, and first of all, we know that these functions and the potentials still depend on a couple of parameters of the spin chain, and these parameters change the behavior starting only at 3 loops, and it's quite interesting, you can adjust the parameters such that these functions agree precisely with classical strings. This model I'd like to call the string chain. So it's some spin chain model which agrees with classical strings on AS5 plus S5, precisely. And but unfortunately, this string chain as it stands does not seem to be n equals 4 super young Mills. So for n equals 4 super young Mills, you have a disagreement with string theory at 3 loops. Okay, so I'm almost at the end. Let me just wrap up what I'm talking about. So first of all, I've considered classical superstrings on AES5 versus 5. I've investigated the analytic properties of monodromy of the Lax connection. So sometimes you could say I've done a Fourier transformation on, or Fourier transformation or mode decomposition on strings and curved space. So it's the analog for a Fourier transformation on the curved space. And then, I constructed the spectral curve and finally found an integral representation. In n equals 4 super young Mills, I've derived the S matrix from the dilatation generator. And this S matrix you can then diagonalize and periodize by a nested beta ansatz. And finally, I've generalized this to the complete model by using both informations. Finally, what needs to be done is maybe to derive the S matrix for the complete model. So we've only derived the S matrix in a smaller sector, derive the beta equations, and then generalize the beta equations. But we also tried to generalize the S matrix in the first place. And then do a nested beta ansatz for this new dynamic model. which is not quite clear how that can be done. And I think the most important one problem is still to understand the mismatch at tree loops and whether this is maybe an order of limits issue or maybe there are some interactions which wrap the spin chain. Or it's not quite clear. So that's it. Thank you very much.
So your last word, where you think that the problem with mismatch lies in spin chains.
You can't really say that because whenever there's a problem, you could say, okay, I mean, here's one. The two curves don't meet, so you can't say which is the problem, where the problem really lies. Here the problem lies, it doesn't go there, and here the problem lies, it doesn't go there. So, you have to find an explanation on both sides.
So you're not certain that it's just a problem on the spin chain side?
No. Well, I think you should find an explanation on both sides. Maybe on one side it's easier, but I can't really say.